Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
The names of more than 102,000 brave Australians are engraved on the Roll of Honour at the Canberra War Memorial. The name of Damien Tomlinson was very nearly added to that list in 2009 if it wasn't for the dedication and bravery of his fellow commandos serving by his side in Afghanistan. Damien, an honour to meet you. Welcome to Open House. You're pretty candid about your teenage years before joining the military. You just couldn't find your place in the world, could you?
Yeah, my background wasn't bad. I mean, I had all the advantages you could ever want as a child. I just opted not to use them. You know, I didn't really make good decisions when I was young, and I probably looked at some influences that weren't the greatest, and then hit a stage where I just decided I had to sort of turn it all around and actually make something of myself.
Your granddad was one of the Rats of Tobruk.
Yes, he was. So, I mean, an extremely proud military heritage, which is sort of what turned my direction into going, I might have a look at what this entire army thing offers.
What were your perceptions of the armed forces through your granddad's eyes?
I mean, through my granddad's eyes, there was such pride attached to what happened, like, especially with our World War II soldiers, you know. I mean, it touched, and World War I and II, sorry, I mean, it touched so many Australians. You were generally, if not in sort of affected directly, you were sort of one step removed from being affected directly by a soldier going to war. So there was that, I think.
Did you ever go to the marches with your granddad?
I used to watch him. I used to watch him on the Anzac Day march. We'd sit there with Mum, and she'd start telling stories about him and stuff like that. And we'd sit there and wait for him to march past. It was great.
Were you always going to sign up for the commando regiment, the elite forces, or was that something that kicked in after you signed up?
Well, it was always there. I mean, I think I'd always had that, an ego. Like, my eyes have always been bigger than my stomach. And there was a thing that they had called the Special Force Direct Recruiting Scheme, which there was a shortfall seen in the amount of Special Forces troops we had and the type of conflicts that were continually sort of rearing their head. So 4RAR, or the 4th Royal Australian Regiment, was re-rolled as a commando regiment once they'd passed and completed all the tasks that they had to do. And they just didn't have enough manning to fill it. So they started working out that we could probably take guys off the street who have the right attitude, right physical sort of attributes, put them through their basic training, rifleman training, some advanced infantry training, and then train them as Special Forces troops. I was lucky enough to get selected in that program.
I suspect luck had very little to do with it. I'd imagine it was a pretty demanding induction process.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I worked really hard. You know, yeah. I worked, which was a sort of a great thing. I mean, I got turned away the first year that I went there. They just said I was too immature, you know what I mean? Rather than having, that was a position I've been thrown into a number of times before when I was young, but this time I'm really glad I actually decided, no, I'm going to stick with it. This is something that I want to do and I believe that I can do it.
Damien, as much as the armed forces in their induction program prepare you for death, prepare you for injury, when did it get real for you?
When I was in East Timor and I was sitting down with a mate who basically said, you know, it was his kid's birthday, and I said, well, okay, man, I don't know what that's like. You know, I don't have kids. And he goes, no, you don't get it. He's 4. And I'm like, okay, you're right. I probably don't get it. And he goes, I haven't seen one of them yet.
Goodness.
You know, and then when you hear stuff like that, you start realizing what people actually sacrifice for the job and things of that sort, you know. And then our unit took one of the first casualties in Afghanistan when I was in East Timor. So Private Luke Worsley. So, I mean, that started to really ram home sort of the situation that I was in, but I think I'd already basically signed that line, you know. I'd made the choice, and I'll be clear on that as well, not choice, not sacrifice, that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to represent.
So April 2009, describe the environment that you were serving in Afghanistan, physically, what the place was like.
It's quite desolate. I mean, it reminds you, because we were in sort of central, in, I guess, country Afghanistan, and it reminds you a lot of some specific areas in sort of South Australia and moving towards Central Australia, some mountainous regions there. But it was about, when I got injured, it was 11:30 at night. We were moving into an overwatch position with our snipers. And as we drove up that hill, I was the fifth car in line, and my vehicle set off an IED. Like, it basically tore the vehicle open, like a sort of can open the vehicle. And yeah, then, I mean, everything's dark too. You've got no light. Everyone's under night vision. So from there, it was a matter of orientating, then finding me, I think, in the mess, and then working out what what was going to happen from there. You know, I mean, I spent 56 minutes on the ground. So it's an amazing effort from the boys around me.
You've lost your legs at this point?
I'd lost one of them, and the other one had been rolled up quite brutally broken, and the skin quite mangled on it. I think that there was no shoe left on it. I had my pants cut off, but there wasn't... I think every bone was basically broken until sort of halfway up the shin. So there wasn't much saving it.
Had you seen any of the injuries like you sustained prior to this point?
No. I witnessed Brett Till be killed by an improvised explosive device, which was, I think, a moving experience. But I'd never personally seen anything. And that's something that still blows me away with it. I mean, you can see injuries like that, but then it becomes so much more personal, which is something that you can't train anyone for.
Yeah.
When someone's put into a situation where one of their best mates, we go surfing together, you know, I mean, we used to play golf. You see that, and now all of a sudden you're not just saving a life doing like a mechanical repair on something, you know, that life that you're saving has a personality, you know him, you know, I mean, he's one of your brothers. So, yeah, it just blows my mind how they held it together that night. It's just an amazing effort.
When did your girlfriend and your mum and dad find out what had happened, and how did that take place?
I've heard two or three different stories of this. My girlfriend got notified at the same time as mum and dad. Apparently, they were on the golf course. I'd originally heard that soldiers rocked up to the front door, but now there's, yeah, I think that actually happened after they'd arrived home, after finding out from my sister, who was the first one to find out. It's always a face-to-face thing, and that, I think, was the thing that really worried mum. You know, when she opens that door and sees the two guys there, they're wearing berets, medals, you know, and basically standing there in their full poly uniform, like full official dress, you know, that's generally no news is good news. I mean, and that's
not a pretty sight, is it?
Yeah, I mean, that, especially coming from a military family, you know, I mean, I can't imagine what was happening, like, with her heart right at that stage, you know. It would have been on fire, so, yeah.
Your injuries, let's go through those now. You've lost both your legs, and what's gone on with your upper body?
So my right leg above the knee, a fair way above, my left leg below the knee. My right hand had two bone metacarpals broken, my right wrist was broken, my elbow was hanging out a hole just up, the humerus, the olecranon was shattered, that arm was dislocated, my nose was broken really badly, I think the steering wheel hit it when it was folding out, tore part of my lip, and my left arm had the radius and ulna were both broken, and one bone in the hand was broken.
The reason I ask that question is not to dwell on the injuries, but what comes next. Your recovery is astonishing. From the moment you start getting active rehabilitation treatment, how long before you're out on the tarmac, as you call it, to greet your boys?
Yeah, I mean, that was great. That's a driving influence, you know, when you're working out ways to be able to stand up and walk again. I think you need something to drive you. It's all about finding what motivates you. And to me, I thought that the boys would basically have tattooed on their mind what they had to see that night. And I just wasn't comfortable with it. You know, I wasn't comfortable being in a hospital room when they were still out, possibly not sleeping, not eating, doing the job. You know, it just didn't feel right where I was. So my goal was to be out walking when I saw them. So I was up standing on the legs for the first time. It was about 6 weeks. After the injury, I actually got on prosthetics. Then by 8 weeks, I was walking decently, and it would have been, I think, at the 10 or 11 week mark. I was standing there at the end of the tarmac when they actually walked down that tube and landed at Sydney Airport.
Did they know you were going to be there?
No, they didn't at the time. So, I mean, there's a lot of the guys that you work with, you know, the military bridges the gap between sort of a family and work colleagues, you know what I mean? So there was a lot of really happy faces from a lot of guys that I have a huge amount of respect for. You know, my team came and stood behind me. It was just one of the proudest moments of my life.
Your best mate, Private Scott Palmer. There's a sad postscript to that story, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, he did work on me when I hit the ground. Apparently, he was one of the first people to lay hands on me, and he was part of the scene that kept me alive. And then on the 21st of January in 2010, Scotty was killed in a chopper crash. So, yeah, it was it's kind of a pretty emotional finish to that thing. You know, I mean, it's really hard to describe how it feels when someone who's been instrumental in saving your life is taken doing the job that he loved.
This was only a short time before he was due to rotate out.
Yeah, 7 days. So this was their last job and everything. So all I would have had to do was land that job, clean all their stuff, and they're on their way home. So, and after that, he was getting out of the army, from what his dad tells me. So, yeah, I mean, he was 7 days from the end of his career.
So you've remembered Scotty's life and your camaraderie in a really unique way. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Ray's father. I love Ray. Ray, he's great. He hit me up when we were at a pub. I'd been asked two or three times to do it before, and he was telling me how, you know, Scotty was going to get out of the army, and, you know, it was kind of heartbreaking, you know, to see someone's dad standing there telling you about it. And then he basically said, you know, what we're going to do is walk the Kokoda track. You know, I'm fighting back tears. I'm holding them, doing as much as I can just not to sort of basically burst out crying, because I know that Ray needs sort of strength from us at that stage. And then he goes, oh, Damien, I want to do it with you in Scotty's honour. So, I mean, I instantly just said, well, yeah, Ray, let's do it.
This was a particularly lonely time for you, though, wasn't it, Damien, in so much as you're adjusting to life outside of the army, compounded by your injuries. These were the best and worst days of your life in the armed forces, and now you were on your own.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of it. There was a huge identity crisis going on of, you know, who am I now? What direction am I going to take in the future? What do I do? But I knew that I had to put a brave face on just for the rest of the boys who were still going over, so that they're still confident in their ability to be able to pull through anything, and for everyone else that sort of sees it, just to, I guess, let them know that, you know, everything's going to be fine if something does go wrong in their life. And I put that on hold because, I mean, my problems are secondary to making sure that my boys are okay. That's part of the commando sort of ethos. So I decided that I was going to walk that track with Ray and put all those sort of demons to sleep just while we went through the 96 kilometres of torture, and do what I can just so that Ray could get an extra hour's sleep a night, mate. That's all that mattered to me.
Damien, you've dedicated your life to lifting others up out of some pretty dark places. Tell me about the moment you told friends, family, your commando mates that you were planning on competing at the Sochi Winter Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, everyone sort of was behind it. It was, I think there were enough people along the way that had sort of said, no, I don't think that you can do it. But no one really looked at it twice. They were kind of like, well, I don't want to say I don't think that you can do it, because the next thing you'll be doing is rubbing an Australia jacket in my face. So I did everything I could. I mean, I put a boatload of effort in. I went down and trained as hard as I could. I went to the US. I got the best trainer and coach on the planet when it comes to adaptive snowboarding riding. And yeah, I did just about everything I could, but I sort of had a couple of interesting setbacks. I broke my back when I was in Utah 1 year. So yeah, I fractured my L2 vertebrae, which was an interesting one. I actually thought that was good, but because that was basically, I'd broken something on every limb then.
Right, well, we evened up the score, right? How should the spine get away with it?
Yeah, that's it, mate.
So you were told you weren't going to Sochi.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking, but I mean, that's a similar situation that I was in after I wanted to join the army. You know, I mean, it was kind of that, well, you can wait for 12 months. Now it's just a 4-year wait, and it's about strategizing and working out the best way that I can still achieve my goal, which is, again, to represent Australia in the Winter Paralympics.
What are you doing on Anzac Day, Damien?
On Anzac Day, I'm lucky enough to be speaking at the Dawn Service at North Bondi, which is where I live, so it's an extremely, extremely big deal for me. I'm also doing a few different things when it comes to raising awareness for the Anzac spirit, doing a paneling spot on Studio 10, So and then going out and flipping the coin for the Sydney Roosters game against when they actually dominate the St. George Dragons, which would be great.
I won't ask you where your allegiances lie there, but for those of us who are never likely to serve, for those of us who are past that age, those of us who look on at the march on Anzac Day, what's the importance of that day?
The importance of that day, I think, is to reflect on what that particular group of Australians and especially families around it. You know, we're all Australians, servicemen, they're all Anzac. Us really reflecting on the sacrifices that they've made so that we can live the lifestyle that we do safely in a country that's as amazing as Australia.
Damian Tomlinson, it's a story that's nowhere near completed. Thank you for what you've already recorded in your first book. I can't wait for the second one to come out.
Yeah, chapter's still being written, mate. Chapter's still being written.
Yes, we'll be thinking about you and looking out for you on Anzac Day. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much. Cheers.